Anyone pick up at the end of last time the attendance list? We'll have to start all over again. Okay. Never mind. Okay. For those of you who just came from the Lingus, it was confused, and this confusion is exactly what Kant is interrogating in the third critique, namely the different forms of non-meaning. The difference between the logic of the beautiful, the logic of the sublime. There are things that Kant doesn't interrogate, like the logic of cruelty, the return of the repressed, and it's very important that we both understand how these different forms of non-meaning have their own logics, and then later on, as a second step, we find some way of connecting them. Well, good, but who knows if we'll manage that. Okay, I'm going to resist going back to last week, because I think we ought to start the book. I don't know, where are we, week 4 or 5, and we're on paragraph 1. As Adam said at the end of last time outside, he said the problem with the first introduction is it says everything all at once. And that is the problem with it. Now we're just going to go much more slowly through the logic of Kant's argument. My reasons for starting with reflective judgment is precisely because it locates the question of non-meaning as a form of judgment, right? That reflective judgment is exactly the attempt to encounter, say, the individual for its own sake without subsuming it under a concept.
I'm just worried about calling it non-meaning unless we stipulate that meaning is conceptual meaning, because it could be locating another order of meaning.
Right. Okay. And I do mean conceptual meaning. Kant's case, yes, okay. Absolutely. And that was another issue in his talk, confusion between different kinds of emotions, some of which were surprising and some of which were somehow overlooked that we have all the time, right? Why those emotions as important. Okay, let's then begin with paragraph 1. And I'd like at least to get through the first 2 moments today, and we'll see if we can get a bit further. Paragraph 1 covers terrain that we have already examined, but with a couple of twists. The judgment of taste refers to the presentation of an object to the subject, and it is a presentation whose appraisal is a source of pleasure or displeasure. And it is because it is a judgment of a beauty is, above all, a source of pleasure or displeasure, that it is, for Kant, fundamentally non-cognitive, therefore aesthetic, therefore subjective. In the second paragraph of paragraph 1, section 1, he says, to apprehend a regular purposive building with one's cognitive power is a very different from consciousness of the presentation with a sensation of liking. here, the presentation is referred only to the subject, namely to the feeling of life. The feeling of life under the name feeling of pleasure or displeasure, and this forms the basis of a very special kind of discriminating and judging. So Kant says that there is a feeling of life. How are we to take this feeling of life? What is he thinking about? At the very, very beginning of a very, very bad book called On Beauty and Being Just, Elaine Scarry, it's a very bad book because she wants to say that beauty is the experiential lure and stand-in for everything that is good, for knowledge and truth and equality and justice. It's just in an affective mode, right? Beauty's all those things. Which is to say, it's slightly idealizing. Nonetheless, she does hit upon something that seems to me phenomenologically true, and indeed sometimes is too obvious to mention or too embarrassing to mention, and it's this. After recounting the story of Odysseus being washed up on the shore to confront, as if a metaphor for his not drowning, the incomparable and astonishing gorgeousness of Nausicaa, Scarry bluntly contends that beauty is life-saving. Beauty quickens. It adrenalizes. It makes the heart beat faster. It's animating. It makes life more vivid, animated, living, worth living. Said all at once. And what holds, she says, for the experience of beauty, its animating character, is, according to Scarry, projected upon its objects. Their being perceived as beautiful seem to bring them to life or to make lifelike. In some cases, maybe in all, this can be called a mimesis of life. Now, all right, let me just say a word more about Scarry, and then I'll move back to Kant. So her first take is that part of the notion of aesthetic pleasure is there really is a feeling of animation. And you'll see the same terms in Kant, the animating of the relationship between the imagination and the understanding. And it is anyway clear, at least for Kant, that the notion of pleasure is something that can only be ascribed to beings who have a biological life. That to imagine a notion of pleasure without that substratum of being alive seems unintelligible. What Scarry misses is that in her own account, this experience of beauty as life-saving occurs only in utter proximity to near death. that it's only as Odysseus is saved from drowning, right, that he has this intense experience. Later, as she attempts to provide beauty's enlivening power with its properly ethical force, she says that the requirements placed on us by the aliveness of all persons these requirements, she says, lead to the more general manifestation of the same phenomenon which are visible in the way in which in one's daily unmindfulness of the aliveness of others, how that is temporarily interrupted in the presence of a beautiful person. That is, even that as we walk around the world, she's suggesting, we somehow don't grasp the aliveness of our fellow creatures. And what she seems, and that the appearance of a beautiful person kind of catches us off our guard because we are suddenly enlivened and see this beauty before us as itself, let's call it, a sign of life. What I would only want to pick up at this point and leave as a question mark is, how are we experiencing other persons when we are not noticing their aliveness? In what sense do we not experience either ourselves, since up until that moment apparently we did not feel animated or alive? What state were we in prior to the experience of beauty? And what does that state have to do with the appeal or the significance of beauty? I just want to have that as a question. I'm going to come back to it in about 3-4 weeks. Although I'll say much more about life later on today, but for now I just want to raise the question of, if beauty is enlivening, what does that say about our non-aesthetic moments of existence? And what does that say about the role of beauty in our lives? Pleasure, in Kant, is defined as the feeling of the furtherance of life, and displeasure as the feeling of the restriction of our life. One almost wants to say that all displeasure is a kind of memento mori. Aesthetic pleasure heightens the sense of my existence, where to exist is at least to be alive. And it therefore furthers my feeling of being alive and is significant thereby. Now, I take it matters to the import of aesthetic experience that the feel that in it we feel more intensively, more engaged, more vital than an everyday experience. And it matters that in this aesthetic experience, since much of it is contemplative, which is to say mental, my mental life is somehow connected to my biological life. which is to say that in aesthetic experience, mental life is experienced as the life of a living being, which is certainly not the case, I would argue, in non-mental, say, rational cognition. Indeed, some of the great pleasures of, say, philosophy is how it lets you forget your embodiment. Now, all these, I take it, are ways in which that little business about the question of life that I raised two lectures ago touches directly on the questions of aesthetic reflection and therefore on cognition generally. So, at the very outset of his argument, Kant is at least suggesting that the pleasure in the beautiful is a experience or re-experiencing of our of the relationship between our mental life and our bodily existence. In the Critique of Practical Reason, Kant says that life is the faculty of a being by which it acts according to the faculty of desire. So that life is connected to the structures of desire, what moves us to act in particular ways, and that pleasure, in this case, is the idea of the agreement of an object or an action with the subjective conditions of life. Let me repeat that. Pleasure, he says, I think this is page 9 in a footnote, pleasure is the idea of the agreement of an object or an action with the subjective conditions of life. That is, if we desire something, we desire it because we think it will satisfy a life need, and therefore we experience the object, the pleasure in the satisfaction of the desire, as something which accords with the subjective conditions of life. Because this sort of state is pleasurable, it is a state we attempt to preserve. So to be in a pleasurable state is one we seek to preserve. Now, connected to all this, remember, the title of paragraph 1 is A Judgment of Taste is Aesthetic. And I'm trying to get at what's aesthetic about, namely, the pleasure. Right? This is what he's first interested in here. And he then has to discriminate, and this is what the rest of this section will deal with, discriminate the kind of pleasure appropriate to aesthetic reflective acts as opposed to other forms of pleasure. So he wants to say that a judgment of taste is aesthetic because the judgment of beauty, X is beautiful, expresses a claim about our being in a pleasurable state in our response to the object. And we're going to say a pleasurable state, yeah, that others ought to enjoy. Yeah.
When you were explaining the quote from the Huffleby, you said that you said this thing that what we find pleasurable, pleasure is something that we think makes us, makes our life heightened. But the other one you said that pleasure is actually what does make our enliven us, and that's the distinction. And I wanted to know which one it was, whether it's pleasure, something that we think makes us more alive. So I choose to drink more because I think it makes me, or in the fact that it does not make me more alive, does that make it actually a false, I mean.
Are there false pleasures?
There's a difference between something that actually does make me feel alive versus something that I think makes me feel alive. I desire it versus it actually does.
From the critique of practical reason, the argument is based on the logic of desire. So I desire those objects and you always desire objects under a description. So you desire them so they are things you seek because they are believed they will be satisfied.
Not because they actually do give me pleasure, because I desire them because I think
right.
they will give
no.
me pleasure.
Although that's right. It's a belief, and if you remember in Descartes' Doctrine of the Soul, Descartes worries about it because he thinks that desires are neither true nor false, and therefore he spends a whole lot of time worrying about wormwood. that is desires for things that are actually harmful to us. Because he wants the world of desire to be belief-free and non-cognitive. That is, he wants to say desires, what we desire is good and what we seek to avert is bad, and they are neither true nor false. Right? So the whole structure of Descartes is trying to separate out the domain of desire from the domain of cognition. Kant has a far more nuanced conception of desire than that, and certainly allows beliefs to enter in. Right. But having the desire, and of course pleasure itself, is, in satisfying desire, what subjectively enhances our life. So the two parts are related, but they're not direct entanglements. Okay, the faculty that apprehends the beautiful, Kant says, is a very special faculty of discrimination and judgment. It is a faculty of appraisal. What is judged or appraised aesthetically through this faculty is the capacity of a representation to occasion an enhancement or a diminution of one's cognitive faculties in their cooperative activity. Let me say that again, I can see you. What occurs in the appraising of an aesthetic reflective judgment? Is that the object, the faculty itself, is the capacity, is the judgment of the capacity of a representation to occasion an enhancement or a diminution of one's cognitive faculties, namely imagination and the understanding, in their cooperative activity. Now, because that we take it that they do this, that aesthetic representations provide this, so he says at 2:22, which is the end of paragraph 12, he says, for this consciousness in the aesthetic judgment contains a basis for determining the subject's activity regarding the quickening of his cognitive powers. And then after discussing that, he says, this pleasure is also not practical in any way. This is a totally useless pleasure. Neither, like the one arising from the pathological basis, agreeableness, I'll come to that in a moment, nor like the one arising from the intellectual basis, the conceived good, yet, and this is what I'm interested in, yet it does have a causality in it, namely to keep us in the state of having the presentation itself and to keep the cognitive powers engaged in their occupation without any further aid. And then the famous phrase, we linger in our contemplation of the beautiful. And that's all I wanted, the lingering. That's the thing here. And if you want to compare that, I won't read it out, but compare it at 242.3, he talks about the opposite, namely boredom, where we don't want to linger. So, judgment reflects, compares, it is the feeling that appraises the results of the reflective activity. So, and I'll come back to this, but I want to say that there are really two acts of judgment involved in an aesthetic, and all the debates about the structure of the third critique really are how these two aspects of aesthetic appraisal work together. The first act is the appraising of the object, which is to give rise to a harmony of the imagination and the understanding. There is equally, and we have to figure out at the same time, later, in what relationship, it's going to be a mess, this is why paragraph 9 is almost unreadable. There is a second judgment, which is the judgment of taste proper, that, let's call it, is, for the moment, let's simply say, it is a form of the reflective endorsement of what occurs in this state. So we have this as a judgment of this, so we'll call this the endorsing judgment. And the problem here is it could be the case that the endorsing, the wanting to linger, after all, is also a source of pleasure. So one of the questions we're going to ask, one of the questions I want to ask all day long for the next couple hours is, how many judgments, how many pleasures are there, and how are they related to one another? Okay, so don't panic about it, but just to alert you that it can't be just this. Otherwise, you're just going to end up with a flat causal thesis. You know, I look at something, and I feel pleasure, and that's it. Right? That doesn't quite get there. We've got to have a more complicated account of this, the appraising, and a more complicated account of what it means for us to discover we are in that state and endorse it or affirm it in a particular way. So at the very least, an aesthetic reflective judgment is duplex. right? And the structure, and this is a really vulgar simplification. Yeah?
It's duplexed. When we put it up on the board, are you also saying that our experience of the pleasure is going to have a dual nature?
So far, I'm not saying anything. No, because this is where all the debates are, right? I'm asking, you know, is this the same pleasure as this? Or is this the only pleasure? Or is this the only pleasure? Right? I mean, this is what we have, no, this is exactly, and this is all about what paragraph 9 is going to drag us into the heart of, trying to figure this out. So that's the goal today, is to at least figure out something about the nature of this structure. That's where we're heading today, to get somewhere into the duplex structure. Yeah.
Okay, it just sounds like you've already committed to it being a duplex structure, but then you're saying, but I'm not committed to that. And I just...
Okay. It's because there are different ways of... You can do it as fully duplex, which is Guire's account. You can do it as fully monoplex, but with multiple parts, which is kind of what Allison does, or you can do it as fully monoplex but with only one part, which is what Ginsburg does. I can keep going on, right?
I see.
What I'm trying to do is set it up so you have a vision of complexity without yet any clarity. And I want to do it slowly enough so when we get clear, it's convincing, right? About it. But sure, I'm flagging, yeah.
When you say endorsing, do you mean endorsing in like a private sense, like endorsing the state to yourself, or do you mean it in like as a kind of normative claim?
No, as a normative claim. The endorsement is the judgment X is beautiful. That's the endorsement certainly is the judgment of taste proper. Absolutely. Now, the problem of all this is exactly to locate, part of the problem of all this is to locate the exact place of pleasure. And the import of that is that the effect or feeling of the representation of an object on one's cognitive faculties, insofar as they are engaged in mere reflection, is something that can only be felt. That is, how do I know? How does anyone ever know? Did you ever know that your imagination and understanding were acting in harmony? Well, no, you probably didn't. You probably didn't think of your mind as faculty-like in that way. What you did know is that you're in a peculiar state of pleasure. So access, right, to this is via the pleasure, and that pleasure is going to be part of the grounds on the basis of which, right, we judge something to be beautiful. That's just kind of for openers. So the point being that a judgment of beauty is something that at a certain level, even though it's a complex act, I'm suggesting at least a complicated act of judgment with at least two parts to it, however they're jammed together or separated, nonetheless, at a certain moment in that, it must be felt. And that feeling is what one of the things we are trying to, and it's why we demand, right? We demand that the individual face the object, because, you know, I can tell you a lot about something, and you say, oh, that must be beautiful. But you can't say it is beautiful unless you're actually, as it were, face to face with it. So he's singular. So the feeling, Kant says, operates like a predicate. So the feeling serves as a vehicle through which we perceive the aptness or subjective purposiveness of a given representation for the proper exercise of our cognitive faculties. Again, so the pleasure is playing a certain role, right? And the role it's playing is, it's the vehicle through which the pleasure is a vehicle through which we judge that this is apt to generate this, the harmony of imagination and understanding. You can just imagine this little diagram getting messier and messier, right? As things get worse and worse. So it is the aesthetic feeling that plays the role in an aesthetic judgment that recognition in a concept plays in a cognitive judgment. Right? That's the analogy. It's a judgment, all right, but it's a judgment that has its basis of feeling, and the feeling is going to play the role of the predicate. Because on the basis of the feeling, right, to unpack, put it another way, to unpack it's beautiful, is really to unpack the pleasure. Right? Because Kant's saying that pleasure is not in the object, it's in our experience of the object as apt for our cognitive faculties. Okay, that's just kind of a warm-up thought. So, a quick word before we... I'm still trying to begin. A quick word about the long footnote, the first footnote on page 203, that famous and awful footnote where Kant says that he is going to use the logical functions of judging to help me find the moments of aesthetic judgment. And then it says he's going to start with the notion of quality, not quantity. So the first thing is, and this is in paragraph 9 of not this book, but The Critique of Pure Reason, Kant has his famous table of judgments. And the table of judgments has four bits, has quantity, quality, relation, and modality. Okay. The quantity of a judgment is whether it is universal, particular, or singular. The quality of a judgment, all this is just in the critique, so you don't have to just open up your critique when you get home. The quality is either affirmative, negative, or infinite. The relation is either categorical, SSP, hypothetical, if X then Y, or disjunctive, either A or B or C. And the modality is problematic, assertoric, and apodictic. Now, the first thing that we want to note here is that in the Analytic of the Beautiful, Kant is only interested in pure judgments of taste, since only pure judgments of taste focus resolutely on the question of whether something is beautiful or not. So the account that he's going to give in the Analytic of the Beautiful is an account that are going to be our grounds for calling anything beautiful. What are the grounds which, by means of which we call anything beautiful? And that means, what are the necessary conditions for calling a judgment of taste pure? Now, this question of this architectonic, of using the table of judgments, is a great source of debate. You will know if you're reading Guire, he thinks it's a mess. If you're reading Allison, he thinks it's a little bit helpful. I take it the right stance is one that Beatrice Longuenesse takes in her essay, Kant's Leaning Thread in the Analytic of the Beautiful. This is her essay in the Kukla volume. And I'll be coming back to this essay. It's I've been reading through this Kukla volume, which are all simply about the notion of what is reflective judgment. 300 pages, and everyone disagreeing with everyone else. Imagine the level of exquisite precision and messiness in this. Okay, but what Longuenesse says about the table of judgments is the reason she wants to use it as a leading thread is she says, and I think this is about right, what it provides us with is a checklist of questions concerning the nature of the acts of judging at work in aesthetic judgment. So we're not following it slavishly. Rather, we're just using it as a way of thinking what might be the questions we need to ask ourselves in investigating aesthetic judgments. And the act of judging the beautiful is for the purpose that what the functions of judgment point us to is in the act of judging the beautiful, we need to elucidate the meaning of the predicate beautiful in the propositions resulting from that act. Now, in the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant begins with quantity. That is, he begins with the question of universal, particular, and singular, because ultimately he's interested in the question of universality and how it is that judgments can be objective along those dimensions. All aesthetic reflective judgments are singular. So quantity would be the wrong place to start. All aesthetic reflective judgments are singular. It's judging this object and only this object. So rather than starting with the question quantity. He's going to start with the question of quality. And that's because the whole analysis of aesthetic judgment boils down to the question, what is the meaning of the predicate of the judgment of taste? What is the meaning of beautiful? That is, what, if anything, is asserted of the object in an aesthetic judgment? And what is being affirmed, so it's an affirmative judgment, and what is being affirmed in the judgment X is beautiful is the fact that in judging that object we have a feeling of pleasure brought about in the subject by his own mental activity in apprehending the object. So the four moments, I'm just now going to sketch all four moments, just so you know what the broad argument is. It's not a mystery. The four moments are quality. Namely, it's a judgment of pleasure, but it has a negative condition. Namely, it is a disinterested pleasure. That's the first moment. The second moment, the notion of quantity, Kant, in paragraph 6, does it as a straightforward inference, which will be misleading, but the inference is, if my judgment is devoid of interest, that is, if what is presented to me does not have any tinge of anything private about my pleasure, if my pleasure really is disinterested pleasure, then surely I'm allowed to say that everyone ought to feel the same when facing this object. So the object of a judgment of beauty is a claim about the object being of universal liking, where the universal can be just taken as an immediate inference from disinterest. Right? If no private, if interest is always my interest, and if disinterest, then doesn't separate me out from anyone else, therefore universal liking. Well, what am I liking? The third moment says that the objective correlate or the occasion of a judgment of taste is the form of an object, and a form, in this instance, is by definition a purpose, something that has or a purposive has the appearance of being purposive, but this appearing of being purposive is not for the sake of anything. So it's purposive but without a purpose, apart from being purposive for my mental life. But what's the point of that? Nothing. So that's to a purposiveness without purpose. So that whole great Kantian idea that aesthetic judgments are of objects that are purposive but without any external purpose. That's the relation. So the relation is one of purposiveness. And finally, the last one, where it's the modality, and the modality is going to be some notion of necessity, and that necessity is going to be somehow grounded, and at least one version of that claim to grounding, perhaps, is that it has something to do with the presupposition of common sense, a sense we all share. Allison, and I'll just mention this, that Allison thinks that the first three moments simply state what makes a judgment of taste pure, that is, they are definitional in a certain way. So he says they answer to what Kant calls the quid facti. The facts that are under dispute. We have to line up, what are they? So for Allison, the judgment of taste has these first moments of being disinterested, universal, purposive without a purpose, and that raises the question of the second part of a Kantian account is the quid juris, with what right? With what justification? I find that way of looking at it not compelling, and I find it not compelling because it seems to me to take, for example, simply the second moment. It already looks to me in claiming that the pleasure must be disinterested, that we are already in the business of justification. So he's trying to separate the mere meaning of a judgment of taste from the justification of it. And I want to say the justificatory and the meaning bits simply don't strike me as falling out in the way that Allison does it. So if you're reading Allison, you can just put a red mark to that page. It's a nice way to read books. You actually just red mark the ones, the pages that are wrong. And well, then you don't go back to them, right? Because if you don't mark them as wrong, you know, you reread them and you think, oh, maybe I thought this was right with all my underlines and notes. Yeah, there are questions. Yeah.
Could you just explain the second moment again, please?
The moment of universal liking.
Right.
Just the thought. And for the moment, this turns out to be false, but for the moment, this is what he says in paragraph 6. If my pleasure is disinterested, that means that there's nothing about my pleasure that refers to anything special about me. I have no particular interest in this object in the way in which, say, if I was having a piece of chocolate cake, right? It's a bad example because I hate chocolate. If I was having a beautiful mold, now, I have to tell you, I'm not disinterested here. I want it, right? And furthermore, I don't care if anyone else likes it, right? So the notion of a disinterested pleasure is a pleasure that does not pick me out in my pleasuring from other subjects. But if nothing picks me out or distinguishes that it's my pleasure uniquely, but rather just the sort of pleasure that this object occasions, then the claim is I am entitled to say everyone ought to share my pleasure. So the intrinsic shareability. Okay, that's simply a sketch of the four moments. Let's talk a bit about disinterestedness. Disinterestedness is, as I've already indicated, a condition of the purity of the judgment of taste. It's a way of trying to make sure that this pleasure is not mixed up with other kinds of pleasure. Well, if I'm disinterested, what is an interest anyway? To have an interest in an object is to have a desire or need for that object, plus, together with that desire and need, a rational endorsement of that desire and need, right? Because I have some desires and needs that I cannot rationally endorse, right? So interests turn out to be of three fundamental kinds. Well, let's say just two fundamental kinds. Interests can be either empirical, or from pure practical reason. Empirical pleasures are based on antecedent desires or inclinations. Roughly, I tasted whiskey once, and I've got a taste for it. Right? So now I have an interest in procuring more. Right? That's an empirical interest. So it's grounded in an experience. The experience generates desires. So if someone said to me tomorrow, the Scottish, industry is going out of business, I would immediately be on the picket lines, save the Scottish, right? Because I have an interest in the existence of the object. I'm not indifferent to whether it exists or not. I want it to exist because I want to consume it. Okay? And that really holds for all our empirical interests and the pleasures we get from satisfying them. Secondly, we have, because for Kant, there are two fundamental sources of motivation. As we've already discussed, we both have desires, empirical desires. And the other source or spring of action is reason itself, right? All the moral law, which is reason. Reason gives us a desire to pursue the good. Reason is an independent source of motivations. So I think the good ought to exist, right? And I do those actions, plan the assassination of the president. I do those actions which I think will bring about the good for moral beings. Right? Oh God, this is being recorded. We shut down next week. Whoever had it, erase that bit, right? Delete. Okay. But the point is we are interested in the good. So we have interests that spring from reason, and therefore, similarly again, to have a desire for the good is to have a desire for the existence of those states of affairs in which the good would be realized. So an interest, again, is a desire for the existence of certain objects. So interests are things that move an agent to act. And having an interest is something, in something necessarily involves desiring its existence. Now, Kant believes, and this is the fundamental basis of his strategy here, that the interest, so he calls empirical interest the agreeable. Okay. And he calls, that's the third moment. And he calls the interest in the good, right? A liking for the good. Right? And he thinks, because roughly this is the body, and this is the mind, he thinks that these two sources exhaust the possibilities of interestedness. that where else would interest come from? Either it comes from my body, from those needs, desires, things, and the like, or it comes from my mind, my desire for the good. And if it doesn't come from one or the other, and those interests, the satisfaction, again, of an interest, brings me pleasure. I drink the whiskey, I feel good. I assassinate the president, I feel good. Right? Just these simple notions of moral goodness. Kant says that you cannot kill the king in his political life. So I couldn't feel good, it would be immoral. But you do some nice act. Give you an extension on your essay. Right? Feel good. If those two exhaust interestedness, then by a negative argument, because they exhaust the ways in which pleasure can be related to the faculty of desire, then if we feel a pleasure and it is neither empirical, that is neither an agreeable thing, nor is it a moral thing, then it is a pleasure without an interest. Therefore, it is a disinterested pleasure. Okay. Now, one striking feature of Kant's argument here occurs on page 210, where he lines up the three pleasures. Now, I want to do this, and then we'll have a break. So he says, here the agreeable, the beautiful, and the good designate three different relations that presentations have to the feeling of pleasure and displeasure, the feeling by reference to which we distinguish between objects or between ways of presenting them. So already notice, I mean, again, this is what makes Kant so good. So he's really saying we distinguish radically between kinds of pleasures, right? By the source of those pleasures. If the source of the pleasure is the satisfaction of an ordinary desire, right, is one kind of pleasure. If the source of the satisfaction is an achievement of a moral good, that's another kind of pleasure. If it is the experience of an aesthetic judgment, that's a different kind of pleasure. So the sources are related to the relationships of presentation that occur. The terms of approbation, which are appropriate to these three, are also different. We call agreeable what gratifies us, beautiful what we just like, and good what we esteem or endorse, i.e., that to which we attribute an objective value. And then it's the next sentence that blows me away. Agreeableness holds for non-rational animals too. Beauty only for human beings, that is, beings who are animal and yet rational, though it is not enough that they are rational, e.g. spirits, but they must be animal as well. The good, however, holds for every rational being as such, though I cannot fully justify and explain this proposition until later. So we're being told that the experience of pleasure of the agreeable, that of course is connected to the body, is something we share with the animal. Just as Al Lingus had it, right? Lots of animal desires. And our pleasure in the good, we share with all rational beings, and we always want to know who else Kant is thinking of here. Maybe porpoises, but probably God and angels. So this is our godlike capacity. only aesthetic pleasure is uniquely human. So only in the domain of the aesthetic do we experience the unity of our being rational animals. And this thought, of course, is what lies behind, although we're not going to discuss it, but I'll mention it here, all of Schiller's philosophizing. Right? In Schiller, the domain of the empirical, he calls the sense drive. The domain of the rational, he calls the form drive. The sense drive, according to Schiller, is to make everything that is mere form into a content, something concrete. The form drive is to make everything that is merely given into a structure of reason, which we call enlightenment, and we also call, for Schiller, the French Revolution and the Terror. And that the third thing Schiller calls the play drive. And he says, man alone plays. And of course, it is not an accident, but we'll have to think about it, that Kant continuously says what is at stake in an aesthetic reflective judgment is the free play of the relationship between the imagination and the understanding. So, and again, this is, I take this at the moment, I'm just now doing what you hate, just generating further puzzles. But in some sense, Kant seems to be suggesting that uniquely in the case of aesthetic experience, we behave as humans and not as either animals nor gods, but in our humanity. So the question is, what is it about aesthetic reflective judgments or about aesthetics that, as it were, is the source of it being uniquely human in the way that our other motivations are not? Why is aesthetic motivation human and the other motivations either animal or godlike? And I don't have a neat answer to that. Okay. Questions about where we are? Yeah?
Just a quick question on the second one.
Yep, yep.
I thought you said it's singular. But it's that all aesthetic judgments are singular, but they're also universal.
Yep. It's I am claiming of this judgment of this cup, when I say it's beautiful, that's the singularity. It is beautiful. Not all cups are beautiful or some cups are beautiful. Kant says those would be logical, not aesthetic judgments. Right? So the aesthetic judgment itself is singular. The question now about that singular judgment is, what is its status? And I am saying that it is objective. What does objective mean here? It means it is universally shareable. That is, everyone, if they truly had an aesthetic take on that cup, ought to find it beautiful. So that is the modality of it. It's a singular judgment that I'm claiming is universally shareable. Okay. There was a question, yeah?
I just wonder, what's the German word for interest? Interesse. What's that?
Interesse.
So it's etymologically similar to the word.
Yeah.
Because that's me. Then disinterestedness looks like it could be very lonely.
Like a...
Could be very lonely.
We will see how, I mean, the question, of course, Nietzsche, just to I mean, first, you know, Nietzsche said, oh, you know, how do you get pleasure? What kind of pleasure is disinterested pleasure, right? So he was worried about, you know, isn't there a hypocrisy about this pleasure? It turns out, as I'll say in the second half, the notion of disinterestedness is very, very mild. It turns out not to be as deep as one suspects. Yeah.
Is there anything which we find beautiful necessarily agreeable or only inevitably coincident with agreeable?
There will be a form of necessity in the fourth movement. To claim an object is ought to be taken to be beautiful means that necessarily the predicate beautiful belongs to that object. But that's going to be derivative of its universality. But the question of necessity is a real huge thing. We'll come to that. Okay, let's have a break. We're not finished with disinterestedness yet.